The headlines. Russia begins its mass coronavirus vaccination using its own vaccine, Sputnik V, which developers say enjoys a 95% efficacy. The U.S. terminates several cultural exchange programs with China amid growing tensions between the two countries. And a prominent rights group says that France's decision to shut down a leading anti-Islamophobia group risks further stigmatizing Muslims in the country. Well, welcome to the studio in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Russia has begun its mass coronavirus vaccination using the homegrown vaccine Sputnik V. Health officials say that they have opened 70 vaccination clinics in the capital, Moscow, the hotspot of infections. Coronavirus Task Force says that the vaccine will be delivered first to the groups at risk of becoming infected, including medical workers, teachers, and social workers. The vaccine is administered in two injections, with a second dose expected to be given 21 days after the first one. Developers of Sputnik V say that it is 95% effective and causes no major side effects. However, the fast process of its development has raised concerns. Russia has so far registered more than 2.4 million infections, which is the fourth highest in the world. Earlier, we talked to our Moscow correspondent, Marina Kortanova, about the start of coronavirus vaccination in Russia.
About 2 million doses of a vaccine had already been manufactured in the country. And according to the president, this gives an opportunity, if not to begin mass inoculation, then at least to roll it out on a large scale. Presently, two domestically developed vaccines have been registered in Russia. The third one is expected to be registered soon. It is planned that mass vaccination in Russia will involve elderly people as well as those with chronic health issues or at risk groups, along with senior citizens, are to be vaccinated.
Iran's president says that the rising trend of coronavirus infections has lost steam in dozens of hotspots thanks to restrictions. Hassan Rouhani said the number varies markedly from 160 to 64. Red indicates the highest risk of infection. According to Rouhani, 96 cities and towns, including the capital Tehran, are now considered as orange, suggesting lower risk. The president noted that restrictive measures will be eased in areas where infection rates go down. Iran imposed a series of nationwide curbs 2 weeks ago in an effort to contain the spread of the virus. COVID-19 has killed over 50,000 people and affected more than a million others since it emerged in Iran earlier this year. Meanwhile, the coronavirus pandemic continues to take a heavy toll on the Americas, with the U.S. remaining the most affected country on the continent. According to a tally by Johns Hopkins University, the U.S. set a new daily record of coronavirus cases in 24 hours, with more than 225,000 infections. It pushed the total caseload to 14.3 million. It also reported over 2,500 new deaths, raising the overall toll to 278,000. Officials linked the new resurgence to the holiday season. In Brazil, the health ministry announced nearly 47,000 new cases, pushing the country's tally to more than 6.5 million. Mexico also registered more than 12,000 new cases and 690 fatalities. Mexican officials say the real number could be significantly higher than what is being reported due to little testing. In the U.S., Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has rejected a new bipartisan $908 billion stimulus plan put forward in an effort to break the legislative stalemate as the U.S. coronavirus surges throughout the country. The plan aims to address the expiration of key economic aid programs, including an unemployment insurance extension. Wyatt Reed has more from Washington.
For the millions of Americans facing possible eviction and the end of emergency unemployment benefits, it seems for now that little help is on the way, at least from Congress. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said that a proposed new COVID-19 relief package, backed by centrist Republicans and Democrats, should serve as an opening bid in negotiations with Republicans. It's a far cry from the $2.2 trillion bill House Democrats approved in October, and economist Dr. Jack Rasmus says Republicans are unlikely to allow this latest measure to pass either.
We have a centrist coalition here of Democrats and Republicans in the Senate trying to break that roadblock that Mitch McConnell and Trump represent. And, you know, it's sort of a compromise between where the Democrats were and where, you know, Mitch McConnell and Trump are. I don't think it's going to go very far because McConnell's made it clear just yesterday or today that he's not going to offer more than $500 billion. He doesn't care.
With Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin promising to block his replacement, Janet Yellen, from disbursing $455 billion in unspent CARES Act funds, the $500 billion package Republicans are offering would likely consist almost entirely of money Congress already allocated to COVID-19 relief. In the meantime, tens of millions of Americans face the looming threat of eviction as a CDC moratorium expires this month, and over 12 million are set to lose unemployment benefits the day after Christmas. Hunger is rampant, and it's expected that over 50 million people will suffer from food insecurity by the year's end. With so many facing increasingly dire circumstances, authorities in some states are working to bridge the gap in benefits on their own. Legislators in Michigan, Colorado, and Minnesota are currently eyeing measures to make sure that happens if Congress doesn't step in. But according to Dr. Rasmus, that may be easier said than done.
State and local governments, you know, in this $908 billion, I think $180 billion was proposed, state and local governments that are going broke and are laying off workers by the hundreds of thousands now because they have no revenue at a critical time when they've got to be involved with distributing, you know, the vaccines. So state and local governments are really in a desperate situation.
The desperation doesn't end there. The slow-motion tsunami of unemployment and homelessness is already starting to occur in cities all over the country. But for now, there's little many Americans can do but pray that help arrives in time. Wyatt Reed, Washington.
As the UK remains in the grip of the COVID-19 pandemic, the country's health officials and experts are deeply concerned about the effects of the virus on Britain's minorities. Our UK correspondent Richard Sudan has more from the British capital.
Earlier this year, Health Secretary Matt Hancock confirmed what many believed in saying that the government was concerned about the potential disproportionate impact on BAME communities of COVID. Indeed, BAME health workers working in the health service in the early days of the pandemic were some of the first to lose their lives on the front line treating those who had contracted the disease.
The lethal effects of COVID resulting in deaths in black and ethnic minority peoples. And that's hugely disproportionate for African descent peoples within that overall black and ethnic minority category. And yet this government has routinely refused to recognise that the consequence of institutionalised racism, enforced poverty, the ethnic pay gap that pushes black and ethnic minority workers into the lowest paid public sector, public-facing sector jobs has resulted in them being overexposed to the vulnerability of COVID.
As well as concerns about structural inequalities impacting COVID, some have also raised concerns about the potential of some medical conditions within BAME communities being impacted by COVID.
There have been papers in the British Medical Journal alerting to the fact that certain blood pressure and diabetes medications do seem to cause, when there is an infection already, it's more likely to escalate into the disastrous lung problems that cause sudden death. So I know that there is a difference between Indigenous and BAME communities in this country as regards those problems.
Irrespective of continued debates over health issues within BAME communities, the impact of COVID on those communities due to existing structural inequality is to many undeniable.
We've seen with Belly Malinga and others here in the United Kingdom, a rail worker who was spat upon who later died of COVID, and the doctors overwhelmingly Asian and African, the nurses overwhelmingly African and Asian that have died as a consequence of COVID, being brutally ignored by this government, who are now suggesting that it's down to black people and Asian people's lifestyles why they are more vulnerable to COVID, rather than the brutal realities of institutionalized racism.
As the effects of COVID continue to grip the nation, many people remain deeply concerned about the devastating impact of COVID on some of the country's most marginalized communities. Although the debate continues, many medical experts believe that COVID-19 disproportionately affects BAME communities already dealing with inequalities within the health service, leading many to ask the question, what do decision makers intend to do about those inequalities? Richard Sudam, London.
Human Rights Watch has condemned the French government's decision to shut down a leading anti-Islamophobia group, calling the move a threat to basic human rights. An HRW researcher said the action against a group called Collective Against Islamophobia in France risks further stigmatizing Muslims in the country. He criticized Paris for shutting down the organization that raises legitimate concerns about anti-Muslim prejudice. Earlier this week, the Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin, in a tweet, announced the dissolution of the group. The government accuses it of engaging in activities that provoke hate and acts of terrorism. CCIF has rejected the allegations, saying that it intends to challenge the decree in courts. The dissolution of anti-Islamophobia group is part of a crackdown that the French government launched against Muslims after recent terrorist attacks. The country has already deported dozens of Muslims and has inspected dozens of mosques. The U.S. has terminated five cultural exchange programs with China as tensions grow between the two countries. The State Department said the programs in question are fully funded and operated by the Chinese government, dismissing them as, quote, soft power propaganda tools. Washington and Beijing have been embroiled in a dispute over a range of issues, including trade, Hong Kong, security, and the coronavirus pandemic. Tensions escalated further after the U.S. government blacklisted several Chinese firms, a move condemned by Beijing. The Chinese government has time and again accused the White House of seeking to destabilize mainland China by interfering in Hong Kong and Taiwan affairs, as well as in the South China Sea. Iran slams the International Atomic Energy Agency over the leak of a confidential letter sent by Tehran to the agency. In a tweet, Iran's permanent representative to Vienna-based international organizations held the IAEA responsible for the incident and called on the agency to revise its confidentiality mechanisms. Kazem Gharibabadi noted that Iran's letter appeared in the media even before the members of the agency's board of governors could track it down. Russia's permanent representative also criticized the leak. The letter in question contained information regarding Iran's safeguard measures in its nuclear enrichment plant in the central city of Natanz. Homolesky says the International Atomic Energy Agency's claim to secure confidential information regarding Iran's nuclear program has not really happened.
This isn't the first time that Iran has complained about this. Just before this recent tweet by Mr. Gharibabadi, in which you just mentioned there, he said that the IAEA should strengthen its confidentiality mechanism. He delivered an official letter to the IAEA's Director General, Rafael Mariano Grossi, concerning the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh in Iran. And he said in that official letter that it is since the first assassination of an Iranian nuclear scientist in 2010, Iran had complained to the agency that the agency needs to stop this release or disclosure of confidential information that contains the safeguards-related information. And this is a responsibility that the agency has when it comes to its own statute and also the comprehensive safeguards agreement that it has with a member state like Iran, as well as the additional protocol which Iran is provisionally implementing. So the IAEA is actually responsible when it comes to the confidentiality of this information, and it, the IAEA itself has said that it is moving in that direction and trying not to and keeping basically the information confidential. But this is not what's happened on the ground. Iran says the fact that its nuclear scientists, for instance, have been targeted is because their names have been leaked to the media. These are confidential information.
Qatar says it would not establish diplomatic relations with Israel until the Palestinian issue is resolved. The Qatari foreign minister announced on Friday that the Palestinian issue needs to be at the heart of any normalization agreements with Israel. Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani said that a normalization deal between Doha and Tel Aviv at this time would not have any value for the people of Palestine. He said that his country would remain committed to the 2002 Arab Peace Initiative that offers ties with Israel in return for the regime's withdrawal from the occupied West Bank. The statements came amid speculations that Qatar would be the next Arab country to normalize ties with Israel after the UAE and Bahrain signed such an agreement 3 months ago. Sudan also agreed to establish ties with Israel in October. A large number of Rohingya Muslims have escaped a systematic campaign against them in Myanmar. They've had to leave the land where they had lived for generations, but their ordeal is far from over. Neighboring Bangladesh is now relocating refugee Rohingya against their will.
Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims have managed to flee Myanmar's northwestern state of Rakhine, where they repeatedly came under attack by the army and extremist Buddhists. Many of these refugees have come to Bangladesh over the past years. They have largely been camped in the southern district of Cox's Bazar in overcrowded camps and in squalid conditions. This week, Bangladeshi authorities began moving Rohingya families from the camps near the Myanmar border without their consent. Bangladeshi police escort the refugees in buses to a port and then to this island. Bisanchar is their destination, a flood-prone island vulnerable to frequent cyclones. The remote island, the Bay of Bengal, emerged from the sea 20 years ago. The government of Bangladesh says it has spent hundreds of millions of dollars on a small city there with mosques and red-roofed apartment blocks. It says the relocation will ease chronic overcrowding in camps at Cox's Bazar. But the refugees are unwilling to set foot on the remote island. There are many concerns about the conditions of the brand new settlement. For instance, distance from the mainland will make it very difficult to reach the refugees in emergencies. Meanwhile, hundreds of Rohingya who were sent to the island in April after being picked up at sea don't want to remain there. They have accused settlement guards of sexual assault. Bangladeshi authorities have not allowed the United Nations or rights groups to monitor their relocation.
It really raises the question, what is Bangladesh hiding if, you know, it has gone to such controversial length to decline offer, consistently offered by the United Nations agencies and UN itself, to do basic safety assessment of the island.
Rights groups want Bangladesh to halt the controversial move immediately.
Rights groups are strongly opposed to the ongoing relocation. Refugees International says that the move is nothing short of a dangerous mass detention of the Rohingya people. The U.N. says it has not been involved in the plan. The U.N. is calling on Bangladesh to allow an urgent assessment of the remote island. The controversial relocation has once again highlighted the plight of Myanmar's minority Muslim community. The Rohingya people have suffered what has been called an ethnic cleansing campaign involved killings and arsons. Despite international condemnation of Myanmar's brutal crackdown on Rohingya, little has changed over the past months.
Rohingya Muslims are recognized by the UN as the world's worst persecuted minority group. In January, the United Nations highest court ordered Buddhist-majority Myanmar to prevent genocidal violence against its Rohingya Muslim minority and preserve evidence of past attacks. The International Court of Justice instructed the Asian country to respect the requirements of the 1948 Genocide Convention. The ICJ warned that nearly 600,000 Rohingya Muslims who are still in Myanmar are, quote, extremely vulnerable to violence at the hands of the military. But since the ICJ ruling, little has really changed. Human rights lawyers and activists said recently that Myanmar is continuing to commit genocide against Rohingya Muslims in violation of orders by the UN's top court. The ongoing crisis has left the international reputation of Myanmar's leader Aung San Suu Kyi, who is a Nobel Peace Prize laureate, in tatters. Suu Kyi has defended the actions of the army and is unwilling to change her stance. Many rights groups and Rohingya activists have been demanding that she be stripped of her Nobel Peace Prize. But so far, no meaningful action has been taken against her or the military.
Myanmar government has not really been put under any type of concerted pressure, you know, not by the United States, not by the European Union, not by British government, certainly not by China or India or Japan.
Powerful states have considerable trade ties with Myanmar. They can easily use their economic leverage to force change in Myanmar's behavior, but they have chosen not to exert pressure on the country over the plight of the minority group.
And that is for World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense.
Another point about the Sacred Defense is that it familiarized us with the embellished nature and reality of the Western civilization. Of course, because the Iranian nation had previously come to harm at the hands of Westerners, the English in one way and the Americans in another way, they were aware of their nature to some extent, but not as much as what they learned about Westerners in the Sacred Defense. Of course, the Iranian nation had witnessed Western government's hostility and treachery in many incidents, such as the occupation of parts of the country after World War I and World War II, and the English's mischief and malice in the south, in Bushehr, in Persian Gulf areas, on the issue of the war between Iran and some other powers, and also on the issue of Afghanistan. They had witnessed the treachery of Western governments, but not as much as what they saw in the Sacred Defense era.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need, my Lord. Protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Lord,
What was seen during the sacred defense era was not less, if not more, than what we saw in Westerners throughout the course of many years. It either equals or even exceeds it. The West was against us with its two faces. Not only the capitalist West, but also the communist West. This is because communism is also one of the products of the West. It was against us with its two facets. England, France, Germany, and even Yugoslavia, which was a country in the Eastern Bloc, moved against us. As for the Soviet Union, it was clear. In other words, all Westerners had deprived us of the slightest resources and weapons. They really deprived us of the slightest resources. We had nothing coming from the outside. We did not even have light weapons and small ammunition.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to
Africa Today.
A nearly three-decade-old ceasefire has ended in occupied Western Sahara, marking the onset of upcoming tensions in the region.
The opposing sides are the Moroccan military and the Polisario Front, the Sahrawi liberation movement that seeks independence from the monarchy.
The Polisario is mobilizing thousands of volunteers to join for the fight after the Moroccan military broke into Guedjerat, a restricted area technically under Polisario sovereignty.
Morocco has publicly and officially acknowledged the fact of launching an armed attack on a group of civilians demonstrating peacefully in Western Sahara.
I'm your host, Mubarak Kenya.
And I am Ikram Abdikarim. Welcome to Africa Today. In this episode, we take you to the Western Sahara, where open warfare appears to be on the horizon.
Now, fighting has reportedly broken out in several areas between the Moroccan military and the Polisario Front, and it could have impacts far beyond Morocco.
I have also prepared news from all over Africa for you. Stay with us for the next 25 minutes.
In Africa's last colony.
I say that our damnation comes from the natural resources we have here. If it wasn't for these natural resources, Morocco would never have invaded Western Sahara.
If we don't speak out, especially us as victims who have suffered all of this, if we don't speak out and defend our cause, this problem will remain.
Hostilities began after a Morocco-built road was reportedly blocked by the Polisario, and the kingdom's trade route with Mauritania was cut. Violation of the ceasefire after 29 years since it was clinched could undermine peace and security in the rest of the region. The ceasefire agreement was reached between the Polisario Front and Morocco after several engagements between 1989 and 1991.
We are sure, as we are sure that God exists, that the Saharan people's objective is independence, and that is a right we must address today, tomorrow, next year, in our time, in our children's time. It doesn't matter when. The important thing is to achieve national independence. The conditions we are living in, the weakness in policy and failures of the Moroccan kingdom, the importance of the Saharan case in the world today, and the focus of Saharan people on independence are indicators that victory is imminent. Independence is imminent.
The kingdom has managed to occupy and administer 80% of the territory.
Since then, thousands have been tortured, imprisoned, killed, and disappeared while resisting the Moroccan occupation.
The media blockade Moroccans have imposed on Western Sahara is also quite infamous.
We are now joined by Mr. Sami Hamdi, Editor-in-Chief of the International Interest from London. Mr. Hamdi, thanks for joining us. Now, can you walk us through the latest round of violence in Western Sahara?
There is a road that goes from Morocco to Mauritania that is used for the transport of goods. There was a protest that took place from the inhabitants of the Western Sahara. The Moroccan government accused these groups of being part of the Polisario. It's not clear if they were. So they sent in the army, which fired warning shots. The Polisario say that the Moroccans actually fired on the protesters. And the Moroccans to that area, which is a buffer zone, built a sand wall in order to try to prevent that road from being blocked again. The Moroccans believe that the Polisario are trying to force a new war, and the Polisario believe that the Moroccans are further cementing their de facto control of much of the territory.
Thanks for that, Sami Hamdi, Editor-in-Chief, the International Interest magazine.
Western Sahara has been occupied by Morocco since 1975 in defiance of the United Nations and the international community. Although the four-decade-old conflict has its roots in nearly a century of brutal colonization by Spain. Madrid agreed to hand over Western Sahara to Mauritania and Morocco in 1975, triggering tensions that continue to this day.
On the 21st of October, Polisario bring women and children and block the crossing point of Gargarat. Immediately, the Secretary General have been alerted by Morocco, and we alerted also the Security Council. And since 21st of July, of October, Secretary General made two calls to Polisario to withdraw from Gargarat, not to block civil and commercial traffic, and also not to change the statutes of this area.
Pro-independent Sahrawis living in the occupied territory stage more and more protest against the Moroccan rule established with the help of the United States.
Morocco reportedly took military action hours after U.S. Major General Andrew Rohling met with the commander of the Royal Moroccan Armed Forces Southern Zone.
We are now joined by Mr. Edward Corrigan, an international lawyer from Ontario, to hear his take on the significance of this meeting.
Well, obviously the United States is a supporter of the Kingdom of Morocco. Morocco is considered a conservative Arab government. It's under, you know, very, you know, quietly supported by the Americans, and obviously the American generals gave green light to Morocco to for any invasions or going into the buffer zone. So the Americans are definitely involved. Morocco has, you know, a history of a poor human rights record, not only in the old Spanish Sahara, but also in its own country. And there's some allegations that the Polisario Front also has some human rights problems.
Now, relations between the Moroccan and the U.S. militaries have grown in recent years, mostly thanks to cooperation over the American military command in Africa, AFRICOM.
Just recently, the United States and Morocco signed an accord that aims to strengthen military cooperation over the next decade.
Morocco hosts one of the largest training exercises organized by AFRICOM. It's called the African Lions Annual Exercise, where countries from all over Africa participate. It's usually held provocatively, I think, in southern Morocco, not too far from Western Sahara. So it certainly does, it's not good optics that Morocco chose to launch this military incursion in violation of the UN ceasefire on the same day that military commanders were in Morocco preparing for the annual African Lion Exercise.
Now, Washington is the monarchy's largest supplier of arms, and it hosts an annual U.S. military exercise called African Lion. Morocco signed a peace treaty with the U.S. in 1786, which is still in force today.
The Moroccan government also enjoys support from some U.S. region allies, such as Turkey and the UAE.
I think the U.S. has been trying to deploy as much as it can in terms of leverage in order to push other countries to normalize ties with Israel, whether that's by making promises of recognizing Moroccan control of the Western Sahara, or whether that's by making promises of incentives to push Morocco to assert what it believes is its right to the Western Sahara. This is all possible. However, it's not a guarantee that Morocco necessarily responded to these U.S. demands. The reality is that there were the road was blocked. There were protests. The Polisario have acknowledged that as well. It does affect transport of goods between Morocco and Mauritania.
The latest round of tensions in the rest of region could spiral out of control. Neighboring Algeria, which is home to Sahrawi refugees, could be dragged into the conflict, potentially causing an all-out war. Major weapon sales to Morocco by the Trump administration have even raised concerns, yielding a scenario which Morocco might be looking for a U.S. recognition of Western Sahara in exchange for Rabat's recognition of Israel. The U.S. even got close to recognizing Western Sahara as Moroccan territory under the George W. Bush administration. Meanwhile, the Sahrawi civilians remain the true victims, wary of empty promises by the UN Security Council and the UN Secretariat, and no resolution in sight.
This is all part of the mess that the Europeans created after in Africa, where they divided up the country in the 1984 Berlin Conference. But, you know, all of the countries and the lines and the map, you know, really don't correspond to the ethnic groups in the area and linguistic groups. So, you know, that's why there's so much instability in Africa, where these countries are, you know, trying to live under these artificial lines. And as I've read elsewhere, Africans just sort of ignore the lines. They just do whatever they want. So that's the issue. So until the Americans get serious and the United Arab, or sorry, the Union, the European Union gets serious.
And now my colleague is ready to present you with news and events from across Africa. What do you have in store for us today, Kram?
Thank you, Henya. Welcome back to more news from all over Africa. And now, on to the first one. World's white giraffe has been fitted with a track device in Kenya to protect it from poachers, as one white female and her cow were killed by poachers in March. Its white appearance is due to leucism, which causes skin cells to have no pigmentation. Parliament approves deal for Rwanda Air to fly to 5 new routes. Rwanda ratified agreements with Brazil, Democratic Republic of Congo, Namibia, Somalia, and Tunisia, bringing the total number of visas ratified by Parliament to 52. The country is also expected to sign agreements with South Korea and Malta. Thirdly, Burkina Faso election takes place amid terrorist threats. People have voted in Burkina Faso's presidential election, although polls are closed in parts of the north and east because of fears of terrorist violence. Now, clashes with police sparked by the arrest of Ugandan presidential candidate and former pop star Robert Chagulani, commonly known as Bobby Wine, has left at least 28 people dead since Wednesday. He was later charged with spreading coronavirus at a campaign rally. Police in Uganda have a right to shoot protesters dead if they reach a certain level of violence, Security Minister Eli Temwini has said. Also in West Africa, Nigerian photographer Obinna Obioma is using creative ways to display an iconic West African plastic bag to reflect on migration, recognized around the world in either its blue-white and red-white varieties. This once nameless bird in West Africa has long been especially popular in markets across the region. Last but not least, Nigeria's economy slips into recession. Sixth, Nigeria has slipped into recession, with the latest growth figures showing the economy's contracted 2.06% between April and June. The country has now seen two consecutive quarters of declining growth, the usual definition of recession. I hope you enjoyed the news. Don't forget to comment, and interactions are highly welcome. And stay tuned for more from me and the entire Africa team today. Thank you.
A full-blown military conflict in the disputed desert territory in northwest Africa could exacerbate the lives of locals already under pressure.
With a protracted war in Libya, long simmering insurgency in Mali, and an armed conflict in Ethiopia, hostilities in Western Sahara add to regional instability.
Now, the Polisario Front argues that the resumption of armed struggle is aimed at defending the legitimate rights of Sahrawis.
Frankly speaking, at the moment, it's very difficult to talk about any peaceful negotiations because Morocco has already launched a military attack on our land and our people, to which we have had to respond. So it all depends on how the developments on the ground. But if you just allow me very quickly to remind your viewers that the whole crisis started when Morocco launched an attack on a group of civilians who were protesting peacefully against Morocco's illegal occupation of Western Sahara, a violation that the United Nations...
The sparsely populated territory has worried international observers, who fear it could turn into a hub for terrorists. Natural resources are meanwhile being plundered, from phosphates to fish.
Now, in order to isolate the southern part of the Western Sahara, Morocco also built a 2,700-kilometer sandwall in the 1980s, which is equipped with a barrier mine belt, thought to be the longest continuous minefield in the world.
I think there's always a risk of that, but I do think that there is little appetite on both sides for an all-out war. And I think the key reason for that is that Morocco has been able to access the Western Saharan area and been able to invest and take advantage of the area economically. I think Algeria is not in the mood to get engaged in a conflict, given that the president is ill, given that the country is going through transition, given that the regime is under significant pressure from its own domestic situation, whether that's Corona or whether that's the popular protest. And Mauritania is engaged in a bitter political struggle, the third player in this, in a bitter political struggle between the former president and the current president.
Rabat seeks to secure passage of trucks to Mauritania via Gargarat border crossing. Morocco has also played down the clashes occurred, asserting that the three-decade truce still stands. But does it? Morocco, on the other hand, says that its activities in Western Sahara are merely aimed at free circulation of civilian and commercial traffic with neighboring Mauritania.
This route is important when it comes to the movement of civilians and goods, and because such actions were a violation of the UN-sponsored ceasefire agreement, Morocco, in order to fulfill its duties, ordered its military forces to intervene and build a sand barrier to protect the area from any future breaches.
Morocco considers the resource-rich territory of Gargarat as the integral part of the kingdom. Gargarat is located on the southern coast of the disputed Western Sahara, along the road leading to Mauritania.
Morocco, because it's been able to develop and invest and take advantage of the Western Saharan area, irrespective of the ceasefire lines, and Algeria has been able to benefit because it's always been able to use the Western Sahara as a way to keep Morocco embroiled in separate issues instead of antagonizing Algeria, from Algeria's perspective. So it may well be that what Polisario is doing is trying to flex its muscles, in given that Algeria itself is looking at other military priorities. Almost as the Polisario is saying, Algeria, we're still here, so make sure you continue to support us.
The Gugurat standoff exposes the vulnerability of Morocco's strategy of driving business growth as a major player in the sub-Saharan economy.
The latest round of violence also represents culmination of diplomatic failures to broker a sustainable peace deal to determine who controls Africa's last colony.
Now, after decades of dispute, Morocco's strategy appears to be refusing self-determination, and Polisario is rejecting Rabat's autonomy.
Power players in the region are also taking the chance to employ Western Sahara as a proxy for a wider struggle for influence in Northwest Africa. So, what repercussions can the conflict have for the region?
It depends if the regional countries are actually in favor of war. I think when it comes to analyzing the Polisario's propensity for war, or not propensity, if they have their desire for a renewed conflict, that all depends on the mood in Algeria, which is one of the prime backers of the Polisario, and the extent to which the Polisario believes that it will be able to secure international sympathy for its case, for its cause, for what's going on in the region. I do think that Morocco itself is not interested in a full-blown conflict. The reality is that both Morocco and Algeria, the two key international players in this conflict, are both happy with the status quo. Morocco, because it's been able to develop and invest and take advantage of the Western Saharan area.
Different generations of Sahrawis have grown up in refugee camps in Algeria, with no resolution surrounding their fate as the indigenous inhabitants of the region. Yet for Rabat, Western Sahara is a matter of national security, and King Mohammed IV has threatened to respond to any threat severely.
The journalists, observers, and activists who come from abroad are expelled. So what do? We break through this blockade from within. We are the witnesses. I'm going to suffer. If I do this work, I suffer more, yes. I'm going to make more sacrifices. But if I don't, I will always live under occupation.
Rabat appears to be entrenching the occupation by betting on time in what it portrays as an ongoing political process. The process, which had already failed, now looks way more distant as new clashes break out and hostilities increase.
That would be serious. Of course, Morocco, I think, is looking for, you know, seizing the resources of the area, and maybe, you know, oil, gas, other things. And Morocco has control of the seaside, 80% of the territory. The Polisario Front controls 20% along the Algerian and Mauritanian border. But it is, yeah, most definitely could explode into something very serious. But, you know, what we are talking about, you know, there's only 60,000 people, 600,000 people that live in the area.
The United Nations has expressed grave concerns over the possible consequences of the conflict. The UN has also vowed to do its utmost to avoid the collapse of the 1991 ceasefire.
A UN mission known as MINURSO is also present on the scene, but will any of that be helpful?
The Secretary General remains committed to doing his utmost to avoid the collapse of the ceasefire that has been in place since 6 September 1991. And he is determined to do everything possible to remove all obstacles to the resumption of the political process.
Just recently, the UN Security Council decided to extend the mandate of the United Nations peace operation in Western Sahara for another year.
Delegates also called for a swift appointment of a new personal envoy of the UN Secretary General to push for the Western Sahara peace process. Now the new clashes are presenting a new challenge to the world body, stopping an all-out war.
It's, you know, a low-level conflict, but it could easily explode into something much more serious and possibly bring in, you know, Algeria into the conflict as well as Morocco, and depending on what the Americans would do, but they've been supporting Morocco and have been consulting them and providing them arms. So, yeah, it could explode, but this conflict has been going on actually for many, many years, but since Spain withdrew in 1975, then Mauritania withdrew under pressure from the Polisario Front later. But it's not a densely populated area. There's a little over, not even 600,000 people in the area.
Thanks for that, Mr. Corrigan.
Today, Sahrawis have no reason to believe in the words of the UN, which promised a referendum in 1991, but has done nothing to make it actually happen. The native population is therefore fighting for freedom as more troops head to Moroccan positions along the separation wall.
I do think that the Polisario, which relies on international backing in order to stand up to Morocco, may find that international backing lacking in this current environment in which the region finds itself in, or in particular the current environment in which each of the individual countries find themselves in as a result of their domestic struggles.
According to some reports, the Moroccan military has shown weak performance in some instances, allowing Polisario forces to take over some positions easily.
As tensions soar, the Moroccan media has mostly remained silent as if nothing is happening.
This is why the Sahrawis' right to self-determination are being denied, a denial coupled with reports of heavy crackdown on protests. People are suffering, but the news never gets out.
That wraps it up for this edition of Africa Today. Thank you for watching the show.
And we pray for the end of violence and suffering all over the world. Until we come back again, it's goodbye from me, Mubarak Kenya.
And goodbye from me, Ikram Abdikarim, and the entire team.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. In this program, we're going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise the children Islamically. The answers are mostly based upon the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. And we have in our studio guest speaker Sister Salma Khalfan, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program, dear Sister Salma Khalfan.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for inviting me over.
Thank you very much for coming. So the question says, how can useful and comprehensive training of children be done? What are the aspects that we should consider during training our children?
That's a good question, because many parents, they want to train nicely their children, you know,
but
they don't know in what regard do they train their children. So here, inshallah, we will look at some of the aspects that need to be considered while carrying out and having the best results in the process.
Okay.
So one of them is guidance. Guidance is one aspect that you should really look out whilst nurturing your children.
Okay.
So a child must be guided towards what is right, of course, from a young age. This includes teaching him of the beliefs and actions of religion.
Yes.
This includes good manners. This includes moral and social values. This includes the adab and the etiquette that a child needs to have, the good manners, you know. So the child should be taught about the healthy ways of living, having good relationships with others, living a useful life in terms of helping and serving others, not being selfish. So this type of training is done through talking to the child.
Okay.
You know, talking to the child is so important that a mother has this, for example, capability of doing. She's always with the child. You know, she, a woman can more relate and express herself than a man.
True.
So a woman should talk to the child and show a good example. You know, for example, she can also, whilst guiding the child, if talking is, for example, not enough, or there comes an age that you need to send the child to, for example, an institute to learn, so send the child to in places like madrasas, learning institutes, involving the child with religious community and awareness of the Muslim Ummah at large, you know. So this is as per guidance.
All right.
So the age and ability of the child must be kept in mind also here. Parents can use the help of teachers. They can also sometimes use help of relatives to guide the children, community members to guide the children, books to guide the